Love Bristol. Love. BCFM 93.2.
BCFM. Usury, which, although more than once condemned by the Church, is nevertheless under a different form, but with the same guilt, still practiced by avaricious and grasping men, so that a small number of very rich men have been able to lay upon the masses of the poor a yoke little better than slavery itself.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. It's the sermon the Church of England's expert vicar is not allowed to give, so we give it for him on Good Friday. Bishop of Guildford's banned him, but we haven't. He's not allowed to say it in his Surrey church, nor on social media, because the Church of England banned author of On Zionism, Reverend Stephen Sizer, for linking Israel to 9/11 attacks on Facebook. And this week, as it's Good Friday, we see if what Christian Zionists say is in the Bible really is. You've heard of the second coming of Christ, but Christian Zionists believe in the third coming too. Also, Dr. Judith Brown spent many years in Yemen and is member of the British Yemeni Society as well as Arab Media Watch. What does she make of recent events in Yemen? Every oil tanker from the Persian Gulf that uses the Suez Canal has to sail between Djibouti and Yemen through the Bab al-Mandab and into the Red Sea. It's a narrow strait. So is this why Yemen really matters to us? To keep those tankers moving, whatever the cost? Plus, it's Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. And we're going to be looking at money as well, the money system, and what, in the general election campaign, they're not telling you about the system. But we start this week with Dr. Judith Brown. Hi, Judith.
Hi.
And welcome to the Politics Show. Now, you're part of the British Yemeni Society. Tell us about them.
They're a group of British and Yemeni people who live in UK who support Yemen and do research into Yemen, give grants for further educational academic study.
So what originally was your link with the country?
Well, I went to work in Yemen in 1998 and I worked for UNHCR.
So that's the UN High Commissioner for Refugees?
Yes, that's right.
So what was the situation that was going on there at the time?
It was very stable, very poor, because they were very badly punished after they, as far as the West were concerned, supported the wrong side in the when Iraq invaded Kuwait, and they took the line that it was an Arab issue and that the West shouldn't interfere, and they had the unfortunate case of being on the Security Council at that moment in time, and because of that they were very badly punished, and that punishment was still really ongoing when I arrived there in 1998. Financial punishment also. Most people of Yemeni origin had been forced to return something that had never been publicised, but that had caused incredible suffering for the Gulf returnees. And all of their grants for unification had stopped. All of their tourism had been virtually stopped because people were told it wasn't safe to travel there. So it had made it into a very poor country.
Well, tell us a bit about Yemen in peaceful times, because you must have spent a little time there when things haven't been so dreadful. But, you know, you're talking about it as a tourist destination. It's quite hot for sure, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, no, actually, it isn't. Sana'a, the capital, is nearly 8,000 feet, so it's got fantastic climate. No rain in the winter and about, 70 degrees, and in the summer, because it has rain in summer, as soon as it starts to get too warm, it starts raining and the temperature comes down. So it's got a very sort of temperate climate, but it's much hotter near to the sea and in Hadramaut.
Is it the sort of place that you think of as to visit in peaceful times as a tourist?
It would be a most fantastic place because it's historically it's one of the most important places. It was really the one of the places where civilization first started.
Because it's part of the Arabian Peninsula, isn't it? Saudi Arabia is this enormous peninsula.
Yeah, it is.
And it's at the bottom. If you can imagine it in your mind's eye, you've got the Arabian Peninsula, which is mostly Saudi Arabia, and then at the bottom, on the east side, you've got Oman, and on the west side, you've got Yemen.
That's right, yeah.
Martin, tell us a little bit about the history of the region, because I know this is part of the world which was largely carved up by the old British Empire. I know there was a guy called Abdul Aziz who was one of the sort of Saudi kings, and we did a treaty between the wars, for example, something called the Treaty of Jeddah, and various things. And the Sykes-Picot Agreement, of course, which was large parts of this world were actually carved up by the British Empire.
Well, I mean, you've covered most of it there. I've got a vague, I do know about this history. I'm probably not as much as Judith knows. But, I mean, the creation of Saudi Arabia, one of the things that strikes me from an economic point of view is the creation of Saudi Arabia by the British and then supported by the Americans meant that the oil industry was located in the least populous part of the peninsula. And you could argue that the oil industry should be to benefit of all of the people in the Arabian Peninsula, and that perhaps Yemen and Saudi Arabia ought to be one state, but not necessarily controlled by the Saudis.
Yeah, it was actually divided up before they knew about oil, so it was just a fortunate...
Well, you know what these oil companies are like. They don't always led on, do they, when they know where there's deposits?
But it has led to a situation where the oil industry has been dominated by the Al Saud family
and so on.
Right, whereas, of course,
and I think that one of the things that's quite interesting about Saudi Arabia is that it was one of the countries that wasn't sort of colonised by the British and the French in the... when they carved up the Middle East after the Sykes-Picot Agreement. And it's also, because it was sparsely populated, there was nothing there. But I think a lot of people believe, and maybe there is some element of truth in this, because it was so tightly controlled religiously by the Wahhabis, this very devout and fundamentalist religious sect. It did at least keep everyone, whereas in the rest of the Arab world, the Arabs sort of like split into people who thought, either we're going to be more like them in order to defeat them, or we're going to be less like them in order to defeat them. But Saudi Arabia, because of the strong influence of the Wahhabis, was all of one mind and therefore stayed unified. And maybe that, in addition to the fact that at the time they thought there was nothing there, it was actually left alone. And Abdulaziz Saud and his followers have ruled it as a monarchy ever since.
Now, I know, looking at a map of American and Western NATO influence, I suppose, air bases, Yemen is one of the only countries which didn't really seem to have US air bases on it, apart from the British, I think, had one at Aden.
I think that in Aden had been under British control for 150 years, but they left in the 1960s when they were driven out. They had actually agreed to go, but the warring sort of like factions and the uprisings in Aden caused them to want to leave earlier, and so they left in a bit of a hurry, and it was a bit of a bloodbath left there, the communist regime took over and actually implemented a very good system of education and a very good system of government, as opposed to the north of Yemen, which had been ruled by Imanate, and although it had been overthrown, it was still a very backward country in terms of education, health, wealth, all of the normal parameters that you measure countries.
So it does sound like Yemen was really poles apart from many of the other countries in that region. So tell us how that sort of expressed itself in the country itself when you were there in the streets.
Well, I have to say that one of the things that really struck me when I went to Yemen was how proud Yemenis were of being Yemeni. Although they were poor, they were extremely hospitable. They never wanted to leave Yemen. They thought everything about Yemen was better than everywhere else. The climate, the food, the way of life, the chewing of carts. They thought that it was all much, much better than any other country in the world. And they just didn't want to leave. And whereas when I'd done aid work in other countries in the world, I was always surrounded by people who kept saying, can you get me a visa? But in Yemen, people were saying, why don't you come and live in Yemen? It was sort of like completely the opposite. People were sort of very proud. It was also a country where almost everyone sort of wore their traditional dress, male and female. And a lot of these sort of like the old traditions that was still sort of like prominent when you went into the old city in Sana'a. It actually looked as if you were walking through a walking museum. It was still, everything that was traded in the way that it had been traded for generations. And, the corn was still being ground by camels. People were still making their goods by hand and selling them in the marketplace. And the welcome that you got everywhere that you went as a foreigner was just quite amazing. I didn't have any guards to my house, and someone from the UN came and said, Judith, you don't have any guards. And I said, I really don't need them, because the whole street looks after me. And if ever I did anything stupid, like forgetting to lock the door of my car, somebody had knocked the door and told me that it wasn't locked. So everybody looked after me, and I felt completely safe and amongst friends all the time that I was there.
So it must be pretty awful for you to see what's going on there now. Tell us a bit about these Houthi fighters. What's their motivation? Who are these people?
Well, this started in 2004, and it started from a very minor thing. The tribes traditionally had always had sort of minor uprisings and kidnapped government officials in order to improve their lot, get a new school, a new road, or whatever issue was on their agenda at that moment in time. And one tribe, which was on the border of Saudi Arabia, they're called the Bakil tribe, did the same as every other tribe, whereas every other tribe that went into negotiations with the government and ended up by getting, an agreement with the government. The government sent in 18 tanks and to attack them instead of negotiating, and killed the person who was the head of that tribe, whose name was Mr. Houthi, and it then sort of like gradually developed over the years into sort of like a bigger and bigger war. I mean, people have various opinions as to why that was done. Some people felt that because the Bakil tribe had been the tribe that had ruled Yemen for 1,000 years before Salah became president, that he felt very sort of like threatened by them. Particularly, other people thought that he was actually struggling with a secessionist movement in the south, and he knew that it would be very difficult for him to military win with the south. Whereas he felt that if he could crush the Bakil tribe, who were situated in the north of Yemen, then he would show to the south that he meant business. And also, other people thought that Saudi Arabia was actually also implicated, and in fact they did from time to time go in and help the Yemeni government in attacking the Bakils, the Houthis, and that was because they saw them as Shias, and by then the Sunni Shia split was becoming much more noticeable in the Arab world, and they were just worried about Shias living on their border, and they actually put some money into the coffers to encourage Salah to attack the Bakil tribe. But quite interestingly, the president himself was from a Shia tribe called the Hashids, and he actually used one Shia tribe to actually attack the Bakhils in the first instance. So it was certainly wasn't a Sunni, a Shia uprising initially, but eventually it just went on and became sort of like bigger and bigger. I think then eventually after the rise of Al Qaeda, which really happened after America started using drones to bomb Yemen, which, as you know, they've been doing for many, many years, it actually raised the number of Al Qaeda fundamentalists, and the military unit of Al Qaeda just got bigger and bigger. And I think that then what were then called the Houthis, because they then a lot of Shia tribes, including the Hashids, had joined the Bakhil in sympathy instead, and so then they sort of like saw Al Qaeda as a threat and really started extending their power over the rest of Yemen. And last August, when I was in Aden, they actually encircled Sana'a, the capital. And recently, as you probably know, the last sort of month or so, they've reached Aden, which is right in the south.
Yeah, ultimately, surely, I mean, Saudi Arabia is such an enormously powerful country to the north of them, with all the oil wealth, the arms. Wasn't it inevitable that a sort of Marxist communist style state wasn't really going to last?
Well, the Marxist state in the south actually ended with the unification in 1991, I think. And since then, it had the signs of sort of communism and socialism in the south had gradually become eroded. There was far more people living in the north, and so I think that after the unification, the people in the south who had a better form of government, better form of education, felt that the people in the north would actually follow their way. But it actually has worked the other way, and the south has become much more traditional.
Does that mean you think it's just a simple sort of divide and rule where there's lots and lots of infighting going on in Yemen, so outside forces are taking the opportunity to, I mean, because we've seen a lot of horrific attacks by these what actually look like the British Tornado fighters that the Saudi Arabians have been using to bomb and kill actually lots and lots of civilians as well over
the
last week or so.
There have been, I mean, they've actually bombed refugee camps, they've bombed people's houses, particularly near to airports. I've got a very good friend who lives near to Aden Airport, and they've been bombing extensively in that area. Friends in Sana'a this week have been saying it's crazy. You know, if you heard the bombing, you would think it's crazy. And she lives quite near to the centre, so they're not bombing. If she's hearing it, they're either very big bombs or they're not just on the outskirts. They're actually much more centrally, and there are a lot of people undoubtedly being killed. As indeed, there were a lot of people, civilians, killed by the drones too, the American drones. And the Americans, although they're saying that they're not bombing them, but they're actually providing intelligence, i.e. telling the Saudis where to bomb, they're also fueling Saudi planes in the air, and they're also going in to rescue any Saudi pilots with American helicopters if Saudis are downed by their military weapons.
Martin, does sound a bit like just another proxy war, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, yes, it's a sign that things are escalating across the Middle East. I don't think there's any basis in international law, as far as I can see, for the Saudis to intervene in this situation. There's been no UN Security Council resolution.
And
you can't just go bombing things because you don't like them.
Exactly.
But they are bombing things because they don't like them.
Absolutely.
Even though there's no legal basis for it. But that means, of course, ultimately, if we're going to have a rule of law, the people who gave the orders for that, and that includes possibly British people. I mean, don't forget, many of these planes possibly being built here in Bristol.
Absolutely.
And of course, you know, ultimately, of course, a Yemeni patriot may decide that, you know, people in Bristol are legitimate targets.
I hate to say it, but they don't actually build planes in Bristol here anymore. I mean,
they build part of them.
But the point I'm making is that this definitely does involve us.
Yeah.
We are definitely behind these killings.
Yeah.
And when people say, well, why do they hate us? Well, this is you go around killing their children.
Yeah.
They don't like it. Would you like it?
It's quite interesting as well because, you know, although President Saleh was the first people to start bombing the Bakiyes, after he was thrown from power, and interestingly, he was allowed to keep all of his money, and rumours are that the amount of money that he was allowed to keep was equal to the wealth of the whole of the rest of Yemen. Mm-hmm. And he is now, although people say that it's Iran that's funding the Houthis, I mean, there's much more evidence that, in fact, Saleh is not only funding the Houthis, but he's also directing them, and it's a way of him getting back to power in Yemen.
But that also suggests that this isn't a sectarian conflict in the way that it's being presented in the media.
Yeah,
this is
absolutely
a local conflict about local power, which has some some religious dimension. But quite a lot of Sunnis support the Houthis, and so on. It's not as straightforward as it's being presented.
Absolutely, and in fact, there's the form of Shia in Yemen. There's Zaydis, and they actually worship at exactly the same mosques as the Sunnis. Even as late as 2000, a mosque was built by President Saleh, who was then in power, and it was for use for everyone. So there was no split between them, even as recently as 2000. I mean, there were some other forms of Shia, like the Twelvers and the Ismailis, who were seen as different, but the Zaydis and the Sunnis were actually saw each other as exactly the same. But there's something that's quite interesting in that, because when the Houthi uprising first happened and Saleh was attacking the Bakiyeh tribe, I spoke to someone in Yemen who presumably was subject to the to what he heard on the media, and I said, well, these are Zaydis, and he said, no, he said, they're not Zaydis, he said, they're a different religious group altogether. He said, we really like Zaydis. So that made me feel that I knew that they were Zaydis, but it made me feel that this was an educated Yemeni. He was a dentist. He's not an uneducated man. But it made me feel that the media in Yemen was sort of like brainwashing people and being unreliable as much as our media is also unreliable. And quite interestingly, in 2009, I interviewed Nadia Sakaf, who was the editor of the Yemen Times, which is an English language newspaper, and I said to her, has the government ever interfered with what you produce in the newspaper? And she said, oh yeah, she said, they don't let us report the correct numbers when they're killing Houthis, because they don't want the numbers to be recorded in big enough amounts for it to be described as a massacre. So she openly told me
couldn't print it in a newspaper.
She couldn't print it in a newspaper.
But you've worked for the United Nations. Yeah. We're in a situation where it's desperate for the United Nations to intervene. Why don't they?
Well, I work for UNHCR, which is a little bit different, but I suppose the reason why UN doesn't interfere is because on the Security Council, you know, you've got America and UK sitting there who want it to happen. You know, that's my guess, really.
Well, what about, the Chinese are there, the Russians are there, don't they care?
Yeah, but you can have a veto, can't you, at the Security Council, so they're not going to get it passed. So,
I noticed also today there's been a Chinese ship has taken hundreds of foreigners off a Chinese frigate, but just that what the Chinese are saying is we just happen to be in the right place at the right time, away from there, and apparently that's the first time that's ever happened. Martin, the Chinese have rescued lots of foreigners from Yemen because of the fighting.
I did see that, but don't forget they also took 30,000 of their own nationals out of Libya during the conflict there a couple of years ago. A lot of what's going on here is not just local. We're now seeing two great big blocks developing in the world, a kind of resistance block, if you like, and a kind of pro-NATO block.
Yeah.
And Yemen, sadly, like Ukraine and Syria, is on the front line of this conflict.
Yeah.
And it's actually being pushed by the West. Most of the stuff that's going on is defensive manoeuvres by the other side, the Iranians, the Russians, the Chinese, to protect their own interests. It's the West that's keep forcing the pace everywhere. And, it's another crime to our name, I'm afraid.
Yeah, I agree.
So the United Nations has got a thing called the General Assembly, which has got everyone involved, but only the really big, powerful nations are part of the Security Council. Sounds a bit topsy-turvy to me. Maybe
Absolutely.
It should be the other way around,
where
the military people are told what to do by the whole of the world
Absolutely.
In the United Nations.
Yeah, wouldn't that be nice?
So also, there's been a big discussion, Martin, over the last couple of weeks in many of the newspapers, particularly the Daily Telegraph, about Britain's defences and whether we should be spending more, and the NATO are saying to Britain we should be spending more, and one of their spokespeople is Rory Stewart MP, who's the chair of the Defence Select Committee, and he was on Newsnight the other week talking about this along with a couple of other people. So let's have a listen to that now. That's Rory Stewart, the MP from the Defence Select Committee, also Bilderberg attendee, and also Simon Jenkins from The Guardian, and Lord West, who's a retired I'm not sure if he's a captain or even an admiral, but he's certainly from the Navy. So let's have a listen to that now. Discussion about on Newsnight, from BBC Newsnight, about the whether or not we should be spending more on our defences, and if so, where should we spend it?
There are two main things. One of them is trying to make sure that NATO has a serious deterrent to stop Putin continuing to challenge the borders of Europe, and that means reinvesting in the conventional capacity, so ballistic missile defence, tanks, planes, ships, potentially chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear warfare on the one hand. And on the other hand, you've got to deal with this new ambiguous asymmetric threats, his use of cyber warfare, his use of special forces, his use of information operations. So it's those things that we're really going to have to focus on if we're serious about protecting NATO, while at the same time concentrating on what we do in these countries such as Libya and Yemen. It is a big political struggle. I think, though, we just have to be realistic. The world is getting much more dangerous. The threat we face from Russia isn't the kind of threat we anticipated. We hadn't planned for that. And we're now facing problems in Yemen and Libya and Syria and Iraq. And unfortunately, as the world gets more dangerous, you may have to spend more. And that may mean spending more than 2% of GDP on defence.
Well, I mean, the idea that you defend Britain's economic interests with 19 destroyers is absurd. I just think this Victorian approach to defence is ridiculous. I want to know what the threat to Britain is. That's what defence is about. It's not about terrorism. It's about the threat to the borders, the shores, the Falklands. Well, we should have defended them in the first place. We were very lucky to get them back. It's long-term, it's ridiculous to pretend that we can defend those islands against a perpetually hostile, close neighbour. The intention of the Argentinians is clear to increase the cost of defending them indefinitely. It is absurd to go on trying to defend them indefinitely. We've got to do some deal with the Argentinians eventually. If you think we should be spending £35 billion a year to save the Falklands from being invaded by the Argentinians, Roy Stewart on the programme kept on saying, we face this threat in Yemen, we face this threat in Iraq, we face a threat in Afghanistan. We don't face a threat. This concept that Britain still has a responsibility to rule the world is an ingrained imperialist attitude which is ridiculous. It means we spend this fixed sum, 2% of our defence budget, which is meaningless. Do you think Putin is terrified by 2%?
What would you spend?
I'd almost nothing. I would ask, what is the threat to Britain? This is about a threat to Britain, not a threat to Yemen or Afghanistan.
Right.
And I want to know what the actual threat is to Britain that needs defending, and what equipment do we need to defend it? We don't need ships and these jet fighters.
Well, I mean, Simon is talking rubbish, clearly. I mean, we need global stability. It's important, and it's important we keep global stability in certain areas, and we add our six penneth to that. And at the moment, we're not really adding that.
This is ridiculous. We've lost two wars, armed to the gills with nuclear weapons, with jet fighters, ships, everything. We've lost to AK-47s. We couldn't beat AK-47s.
Nobody since 1945 has touched an aircraft on an aircraft carrier, and yet aircraft carriers have stopped invasions, as they did in Kuwait in 1961, and there are examples. It's like the great thing about defence forces, ideally, if you've got sufficient ones and can show it, is they stop wars. That is the joy of them,
Your party withdrew from east of Suez back in the 60s. You're going back there. Why? I mean, what is this imperial drive to rule the world? You can't do it. We can't afford
it. It's not an imperial drive to rule the world.
You said we face these threats abroad. We do not face these threats. This is the talk of the defence lobby. I mean, you're in the defence business. This is the defence of people who have a huge amount of money in this business. I face them all the time. I see their articles in the newspapers all through the general election.
Yes, at which point he was swearing about how many times that he'd seen these sorts of articles in the defence press, Martin. But there's a lot of points being made there about where we're going in terms of defence. The world being a more dangerous place, and also talking about protecting NATO, the Falklands, and sort of general stability. So what are your thoughts about some of the points that were made there, particularly Simon Jenkins was talking about we've lost two wars with all this equipment against AK-47s?
Well, I think there's two levels to this, isn't there? I mean, the one level is Simon Jenkins' point I agree with, of course. I mean, if we're rational about it, why does Britain need to be intervening in any of these places? But I'm afraid it's worse than that. The US military-industrial complex, allied with the Israeli military-industrial complex, allied with the British military-industrial complex, is going out and fomenting wars. We are definitely doing that. The narrative about the Ukraine has been completely distorted in the Western media. The takeover of power this time last year in Kiev was a military coup carried out by elements armed elements associated with our own intelligence services, who probably carried out the assassination, the shooting of the protesters and police officers on Maidan Square. In other words, we killed those protesters. Probably somebody in MI6 knows exactly what I'm talking about. And I'm afraid the British and the rest of the world are not regarded as a sort of peacekeepers coming in a disinterested way to provide stability. We are regarded as warmongers because we are, and so are the Americans. Now, ultimately, we are playing with fire here. And, of course, the fact is that the military don't care if they lose wars. They lost the war in Vietnam, but they made a packet out of it. And that there is a kind of elite group, Rory Stewart were definitely part of it in Britain, who still see ourselves as an imperial power. They do, and not only, and they are actually cat's paws for the Americans, who are really dangerous warmongers.
So doesn't it say something?
At some point, we're going to have to confront these people. And if MI6, for example, were involved in the shootings in the Maidan Square, and I suspect they were, then I want to see those people in prison. I'm not joking. I want to see them sent to prison forever.
Going back to Yemen for a minute, doesn't it say something about that Britain and America's role these days, that actually it was the Chinese frigate that was in the right place at the right time to withdraw and evacuate people?
Well, the fact is that there's no reason why we couldn't have a cooperative relationship with the Chinese and the Russians. That surely was what Gorbachev was asking for in 1991. And in 1991, the Yemenis who were on the Security Council voted against going to war over Kuwait because they said there's no basis for this. Mm. And, of course, they were then punished and so on and so forth. And, of course, there was only two Security Council members that voted. It was Yemen and Cuba, wasn't it?
I'm not sure what other...
Yeah, there were other countries opposed to it, but they were the only ones that were actually on the... Because you have the rotating members of the Security Council. Now, these people are dangerous. What's happened with the Russians is over the Ukraine has been provocation all the way from the West, including violent provocation. The Odessa massacre, the massacre in the Maidan Square, the shooting down of MH17. The British have had the black boxes for months, and they haven't said what's on them, because what it shows is that two fighters from Kiev shot down that plane, probably with agreement with their military handlers in the US and Britain. In other words, if we're going to catch the terrorists who shot that plane down, it was not shot down deliberately. They're probably people not too far away from the studio who know exactly what we're talking about. Now, the British don't have this reputation for being peacekeepers in Ireland. They've got a reputation for being murderers, and of course they are. British, the head of the Force Research Unit, Brigadier Gordon Kerr, was fingered by our own police force as a terrorist years ago. And I'm afraid the British are provocateurs on behalf of the Americans, and something's going to have to be done about it. And I don't just mean voting people out of power. Ultimately, people will have to go to prison when we catch them.
Judith, what about back to Yemen? What about ending the conflict? What do you think are the best prospects for that?
Well, I think it's just very depressing. I can't see how you can actually stop the conflict now, because I think that it's now that it's starting to involve, forces outside Yemen, and they're sort of like using Yemen as their arena. I mean, the depressing thing is that I can't see how you can actually stop it. And I think that the Yemeni people themselves are very well armed. But in the past, it had a very low homicide rate, despite the fact that it had the highest number of small arms distributed amongst the population in the world.
I mean, apart from America? There's quite a few small arms are hanging around in the United States.
Yes, but per head, it was higher in Yemen. But wow. The homicide rate was much lower than in United States. That was what was quite interesting.
So why was that? I mean, what was the history behind that? How come so many people had weapons?
People had guns. That's what they had. They'd had guns for decades, and it was just the tradition that men had guns. It was just what they did, particularly when you're in rural areas, you would walk out and see people walking around with the guns over the shoulders. They did used to have that in Sana'a as well when I first went there, but then the government stopped people coming into Sana'a with guns, and if people did have guns, it wasn't displayed openly. People were killed by guns, but it tended to be when one tribe was fighting another tribe, and they'd have a little sort of like fracas and kill, two or three people of each side, and then it would calm down. But they didn't go out killing people for criminal purposes or for sort of like political purposes. You didn't have madmen go in and sort of like spray a school with gunfire. Or if you did, I didn't hear anything of it.
Well, it sounds like it was almost like everybody was in charge of keeping law and order, and that was the way it was seen. Yeah. Martin, that's actually quite a mature society where you can have quite a lot of people with guns without getting shot.
These societies obviously have their own history and trajectory, and they should be allowed to develop freely without outsiders interfering and making a mess.
What about the point I was making right at the very start, though, about that is that the pinch points on the east of the Arabian Peninsula, you've got the Straits of Hormuz. On the west, you've got this Bab al-Mandab, which is between Djibouti and Yemen. These places are both where oil tankers come from the Gulf, round up the Suez into Europe, and they are pinch points, aren't they? So they're places that we've got to keep an eye on.
Indeed they are, and therefore the imperialist desire to control them is as strong now as it's ever been. Can I just make points about Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula? They were set up by two Guantanamo inmates, whose names have escaped me now, who were released under the Penny Lane franchise in Guantanamo. They've had two sections of Guantanamo, one called Strawberry Fields and one called Penny Lane. Penny Lane being that these people were turned, in other words, they were in Guantanamo, then they were released. Two guys released from Guantanamo by Dick Cheney went to Yemen and immediately set up Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. So they'd been in the hands of the Americans, just like this al-Baghdadi character, who's supposedly the head of ISIS. And there are pictures of him shaking hands with John McCain, because he was a Syrian rebel, and we're in favour of the Syrian rebels, and he's one of our guys, but he's now the head of ISIS, supposedly. Now, a lot of these extreme Wahhabist, Takfiri, Salafi groups are closely linked to the Saudi Arabian intelligence services, which is closely linked to the MI5 and MI6 and the CIA. Now, in other words, not only is what Rory Stewart's saying they're completely wrong, the exact opposite is the case. A lot of the very extreme Sunni terrorist groups have intimate links with Western intelligence services going back decades to the war in Afghanistan and before. And what they do is they create these enemies in strategic places like Yemen, and then say, "Oh, look, we're going to have to intervene there to stop these people taking power," and that just happens to be where we want to intervene anyway. And
is that your understanding, Judith? Does that fit with your
view? It does, and I mean, it was quite interesting because when they started recruiting from the Arab world to fight in the Syrian conflict, the interesting thing is that the Americans were bombing in South Yemen with drones, killing these sort of like extremists, all at the same time, so-called extremists. It was at the same time they were recruiting them to go and work with pay as mercenaries in Syria. I mean, there was an article to that effect in the New York Times, which was just like quite crazy, and it's just so what a choice to stay in Yemen and be bombed by a drone or go and be paid to kill other people in Syria.
This kind of thing is presented in the liberal media as we don't know what we're doing, the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing. I dispute that. They know exactly what they are doing. Al-Qaeda was set up as a franchise under Operation Cyclone with with MI6 in the lead as the lead agency in the 1980s, and it was headquartered in London, which is why the French police used to refer to London as Londonistan, because all of the most extreme Takfiri terrorists in the world were based in London as guests of MI6. Guests of MI6. And of course the story is that these groups that we've armed and trained, they got SAS training on how to shoot down airplanes in Scotland and so on, they got all this training, and then they went rogue and we lost control of them, and now we've got to spend even more money trying to get control of back of them. I think we need to look into the history of the creation of these groups, and it's probably people like Rory Stewart who knows people who need to be sent to prison for organising conspiracy to commit terrorist offences, and they're inside the structure.
The other thing that's quite interesting in Yemen itself, they said that the head of Al-Qaeda in the Arab Peninsula was Al-Waliki, this American. I never saw any evidence concerning that, none whatsoever. No. I saw evidence that he was a very outspoken preacher and was very against drones, and that he'd gone with his son to Yemen in order to collect evidence about drones. He was immediately named as the head of Al-Qaeda in Yemen when he got there. He might have been, but I've not seen any evidence of it. And not only was he killed, but a couple of weeks later, his 16-year-old son killed. These were people who held American passports.
Yeah.
And because they named him as the head of Al-Qaeda in Yemen, it was considered, you know, they could announce that they'd killed him. They didn't announce that they'd killed his 16-year-old son by drones 2 weeks later. And also, they had several drone attacks before they managed to kill both of them. Now, why did they kill his 16-year-old son? He wasn't the head of Al-Qaeda.
Well, I've got a guess. Maybe you knew too much.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, I mean, the underpants bomber, supposedly underpants bomber, got on a plane in Yemen, flew to Schiphol Airport in Amsterdam, and then flew into the US and was arrested on the plane. But, of course, we've got eyewitnesses from that plane. Kurt Haskell, who's a senior lawyer in the US, who was on the plane, said he saw him taken onto the plane at Schiphol without going through any security at all. And, of course, Schiphol Airport is controlled. The security at Schiphol Airport is controlled by ICTS, which is an Israeli security company associated with Shin Bet, who just happened to be in control of all three airports implicated on 9/11. Now, in other words, I stress this week after week, a lot of what we see as so-called extremist Salafi terrorism, Wahhabi terrorism, is intimately connected with Western intelligence services. Abdelhakim Belhaj, who's now the head of ISIS in Libya, has an intimate relationship with MI5 and MI6 going back decades. He was involved in the attempt to assassinate Gaddafi back in the 90s. And these guys are actually being run by our own intelligence services. And I think that the evidence is, after Syria, is now overwhelming. And if we're serious about stopping terrorism, and we should be, then we're going to have to start arresting some of our own people, putting them on trial, putting them in front of juries and sending them to prison.
Judith, we'll finish with you. Where can people follow? Obviously, on our normal mainstream news, it's not very easy to follow this stuff because it's pretty confusing and quite often disinformation. So whereabouts could you advise people to go online to follow events in the Arabian Peninsula, Yemen, places like that? Are there any good sites?
I think that it's very difficult because most of the best sites, of course, are written in Arabic. So therefore, unless you read Arabic, you can't follow what's going on. And also, so one of the quite good things to do is to actually have people that you know that have links there or know people that are there, which is very difficult. But I think that there are. I think the Russian television. I don't think you can get Press TV in UK now, but if you can get it online, I think they give a much fuller picture of the things that are going on. And you can sort of like join groups like the British Yemeni Society, and there is a briefing next week for people belonging to the society to keep them up to date on the.
I'll put up if you can give me maybe a couple of website addresses, I'll put them up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk when I get back home. Dr. Judith Brown, thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
He's the Reverend Stephen Sizer, a world-renowned author on the phenomenon of Christian Zionism that's behind the belief that what the Israeli government do is somehow God's will. This week, we see if what Christian Zionists say is in the Bible really is. You've heard of the second coming of Christ, but Christian Zionists believe in a third coming too. So he's banned by the Church of England, but here he is speaking in 2008.
While the United States is invariably viewed with Israel as fulfilling their manifest destiny as God's people, the United Nations, the Arab world, and the European community is viewed with deep, deep mistrust. This has profound impact on foreign policy in the Middle East. Let me give you one example of that. In July 2006, at the inaugural event of Christians United for Israel, after recorded greetings from George W. Bush in the presence of four U.S. senators as well as the Israeli ambassador, John Hagee, who's the pastor of an 18,000-member church, San Antonio, Texas, Cornerstone, said this, quote, "The United States must join Israel in a preemptive military strike against Iran to fulfill God's plan for both Israel and the West, a biblically prophesied end-time confrontation with Iran will lead to the rapture, tribulation, and second coming of Christ." And it seems as if George W. Bush has been listening, because only last month, July the 13th, the Times reported, quote, "President George W. Bush told the Israeli government he was approving a future military strike on Iranian nuclear facilities if negotiations with Tehran break down, according to senior Pentagon officials. Despite the opposition of his generals and widespread skepticism, America is ready to risk the military, political, and economic consequences of an airborne strike on Iran. The president has given Israel an amber light to an Israeli plan to attack Iran's main nuclear sites with long-range bombing sorties, a Pentagon official told the Sunday Times. Now, let me explain what an amber warning is. Quote, "Amber means get on with your preparation, stand by for an immediate attack, and tell us when you're ready," the official said. "It's really all down to the Israelis," a Pentagon official said. "This administration will not attack Iran. This has already been decided. But the president is really preoccupied with a nuclear threat against Israel, and I know he doesn't believe that anything but force will deter Iran," the Times went on to say. Quote, "Senator Barack Obama's previous opposition to the war in Iraq and his apparent doubts about the urgency of the Iranian threat have intensified pressure on the Israeli hawks to act before November's U.S. presidential election." This is the last thing the Pentagon official said. Quote, "If I were an Israeli, I wouldn't wait. If I were an Israeli, I wouldn't wait." And it's tragic, tragic that Christian leaders are saying amen. And are not only saying amen, they are urging the politicians to ignore the rule of international law and initiate a preemptive strike against another sovereign nation in the Middle East. And the irony, the tragic irony, is that the theology upon which this foreign policy is predicated is fictional.
Well, it does come down to theology eventually, but the Church of England's made its mind up. This guy, Martin, is not allowed to speak.
Well, he's been picked out because of his link on his Facebook page to an article linking the Israeli intelligence services to the 9/11 attacks. And I'm afraid, and we've frequently covered the factual matters concerning this on this show, there are fingers that point directly to the Israeli intelligence services being involved.
Okay, give us at least a couple of examples.
Well, the first thing people can look up immediately, five dancing Israelis. On the day of the attack, a local person saw five people celebrating the first plane hitting the first tower and filming it. She gave the number of their car to the local police. 8 hours later, the local police arrested them. They turned out to be five Israeli Mossad agents who were eventually released. But on the other hand, how did they know that there was going to be an attack? When they went on television in Israel, they said, oh, well, we were just documenting the attack. How can they document a surprise attack if it's a surprise attack? That's the sort of thing that's in the article. And I'm afraid this is factual stuff that nobody can... We're talking about factual matters here. They were there. They were arrested. They were celebrating. They were Mossad agents.
Also,
and that's all in the article.
Also, Martin, Southampton University has cancelled a controversial Israel conference this week, called controversial by some. But the conference is about international law and the state of Israel. Academics being invited from all over the world. And the Southampton University Vice-Chancellor has cancelled the conference on health and safety grounds.
Well, presumably because of threats from the Israel lobby. I mean, the Israelis are the Israeli state and the state within a state in Israel is a menace to world peace, as the state within a state in Britain is a menace to world peace. It's not just the Israelis, but nevertheless they are major players in this kind of axis of evil, the real axis of evil, which is essentially the deep state in the US, Britain and Israel.
Well, one of the theological points that Stephen Sizer takes issue with many of the Christian Zionists is with this thing called the rapture, the idea that that the second coming of Christ, Christ will come back just specifically for Christians and then come back later on a third time in what many other people would say is the second coming reading of the Bible. So let's hear what Stephen Sizer's got to say about that.
The theological basis of the rapture and the fatalistic and pessimistic view of the future with its pre-written script that is pathologically opposed to the peace process is a fiction. What is the idea behind the rapture? The rapture is a novel idea that Jesus will actually return not once, but twice. First of all, secretly to rescue true believers out of the world before Midway, or if you're a masochist, at the end of a seven-year period of intense suffering known as the Tribulation. Then Jesus will return visibly with his saints to judge the world. So advocates claim Jesus will return secretly for his saints, and then a little while later he will return visibly with his saints. This theological view of the future is dominant within evangelical circles in America and also in Britain. It's been popularized by Tim LaHaye's Left Behind series, and I won't embarrass any of you to ask you to put your hands up if you've bought one of the Left Behind books, but it also can be traced back to English Christians in the 19th century, John Nelson Darby and his friends, and Cyrus Scofield at the beginning of the 20th century, and the well-known Scofield Reference Bible. To the traditional biblical hope of the visible return of Jesus, they've added a secret return before the time of great suffering and persecution for those left on earth. Proponents believe that in one cataclysmic moment, millions of believers around the world will suddenly be caught up in the air to be with Jesus. Life will then continue on earth for 3 or 7 years for those who've ignored or rejected Jesus. Now, what does the Bible actually say about the rapture? Well, the most popular passage in the Bible quoted is from Luke 17. Jesus said, "I tell you, on that night, two people will be in bed, one will be taken, the other left. Two people will be grinding grain together, one will be taken, the other left." Luke 17, 34, 35. The question is, who is taken and when are they taken? Well, Scripture should be used to interpret Scripture. And the parallel passage, or the parallel illustration from Matthew 13, the story of the wheat and the tares. The servants ask, "Do you want us to go and pull up the weeds?" The master replies, "Let both grow together until the harvest. At that time I will tell the harvesters, first collect the weeds and tie them in bundles to be burned, then gather the wheat and bring it into my barn." So who's going to be taken first? Who's going to be left behind? Do you think Jesus would use two illustrations to describe the same event and teach the opposite in one to the other and confuse his followers? The other frequently cited passage to justify a two-stage rapture is 1 Thessalonians 4:15 to 17. And you may need another strong coffee before you can get this, but let me quote to you the passage. "According to the Lord's word, we tell you that we who are still alive, who are left till the coming of the Lord, will certainly not precede those who have fallen asleep." That means have died. "For the Lord himself will come down from heaven with a loud command, with the voice of the archangel, with the trumpet call of God. The dead in Christ will rise first. After that, we who are still alive will be left, will be caught up with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air. And so we will be with the Lord forever." Now, can you see a two-stage rapture in those verses? John Nelson Darby basically said that if you can't, you won't be raptured. So a whole lot of people said, "Yes, I can see it." In fact, he says you can see it with much precision. Well, I can't, I'm sorry. Let's see what those verses actually say. Jesus will return to earth, verse 16. His return will be associated with loud sounds, verse 16. The dead in Christ will be raised first, verse 16. Those believers still alive will be caught up to meet him in the air, verse 17. We will be with the Lord forever, verse 17. What comes first? The visible return of Jesus with loud sounds. Then the dead are raised, then those alive are caught up with them in the air. It's one event. Nothing in 1 Thessalonians, nothing in any passage in the New Testament teaches that Jesus will return secretly for believers and then 3.5 or 7 years later return secondarily, visibly. The most conclusive repudiation of this idea of a secret rapture comes from Matthew 24 and Jesus' own words. Matthew 24, verse 30. At that time, the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky. All the peoples of the earth will mourn. They will see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. He will send his angels with a loud trumpet call. They will gather his elect from the four winds, from one end of the heavens to the other. Now, Jesus is using Old Testament vivid imagery to describe his return. The great trumpet refers to the silver trumpet used by God's people in worship, Numbers 10. The four winds from Jeremiah 49 and Zechariah 2, they symbolize the whole world. In this way, Jesus will gather his elect from every nation, tribe, people, and language, Revelation 7:9. But again, notice the sequence. One, there'll be signs of Jesus appearing in the sky, verse 30. Secondly, Jesus will appear visibly, verse 30. Thirdly, the whole world will see him and mourn, verse 30. Then there'll be loud sounds, verse 31. Then Jesus will gather his elect, verse 31. Believers will be caught up to be with Jesus when he returns visibly, not before. The whole world will be watching and mourning. What is certain from this passage is that the rapture will not occur before Jesus returns. And nothing relating to the return of Jesus will be secret. Not surprisingly, the Scofield Reference Bible offers you no footnotes to those verses. But that mistaken fictional theology has generated a whole lot of books and a lot of bad theology. And it's the reason why many Christians are not concerned about climate change. They're not concerned about preserving natural resources. They're not concerned about national debt or nuclear war or world poverty, because they believe they're going to be raptured to heaven before the worst. And they're going to avoid the suffering of a global Holocaust. Like a sinking ship, the world is doomed, and therefore there is no point in preserving it or caring for it or being charitable, getting involved in the kind of work that Greenbelt is committed to. Every human tragedy, if it's an earthquake, a hurricane or a war, merely adds to the mounting evidence proving their contention that the world is nigh. The hype surrounding the Left Behind phenomenon is a tragic example of what happens when people major on minors and dogmatize over obscure issues. We must base our faith firmly on the scriptures and the plain teaching of God's word. God has not written off this beautiful world. He's called us to care for it, steward it, and return it in good condition when he returns.